Now, last few verses, which describe the fate or the destiny of the demons.
Tanaham vishata kruran samsareshu naradhama kshipam yajasvam ashubhan asuripyeva yonishu.
Those who are envious and mischievous are the lowest among men. I perpetually cast into the ocean of material existence, into the various demonic species of life. So, here is the fate of the demons. Krishna says, Kshipami, that I throw them, or I put them. Where do I put them? Asuri Shiva Yonishu, into the wombs of the demoniac species of life. Very Ashubha destiny, very inauspicious place. Who does he put there? Dvishata Kruran, those envious rascals, demons. And therefore they are floating, transmigrating in samsareshu. Right? Samsareshu, this is in the locative seventh case, plural. Samsareshu. In the cycle of birth and death, those dvishata, envious people who are also considered to be nara adhama, the lowest of humans, the lowest of all men. And how long does he put them there? Ajasram, forever. So Prabhupada comments, in this verse it is clearly indicated that the placing of a particular individual soul in a particular body is the prerogative of the supreme will. The demoniac person may not agree to accept the supremacy of the Lord, and it is a fact that he may act according to his own whims, but his next birth will depend upon the decision of the supreme personality of Godhead and not himself. So this is all arranged by the Lord. And this is a fitting destiny for those who are vishata, envious, kuran, mischievous, naradama, were the lowest of human beings. Now the word here, ajasra, is translated as forever in the synonyms, but in the translation Prabhupada renders it as perpetually. So according to Apte's Sanskrit dictionary, he says also that it can mean it means non-ceasing and perpetual. I'll read different renditions of this word. Not ceasing, constant, perpetual, ever, constantly, perpetually. So forever is different than perpetually. Constantly is similar to perpetual. It means that this, as long as there is a prerequisite situation or condition, then it will continue without stop. So that prerequisite position or situation or mentality is dvishata, kuran. As long as they're envious of Krishna, they don't want to serve him, and they hate Vaishnavas, and they hate God, and they're atheistic. So this is the same word we were talking about yesterday, right? Ishvara tad adhineshu balesheshu visatsucha. So the visatsu, which is the personification of dvesha, those who are dvesha are called visatsu. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's various kinds of visatsu. Those who are skeptics or agnostics, those who do not accept God has a form, those who think that God is under or is created by man, or is under you know, is dominated by men, and those who have no mercy, absolutely bereft of any mercy. So basically, those who are those people are envious of God. So therefore, they insult God. They say He has no form, He has no power. He's actually under the power of human karma, or they just don't believe in Him, or they have no mercy. So as long as those conditions exist, then Krishna continues to kshipami asuri yonishu. He keeps throwing them, placing them into demoniac species of life. So this is different than the Christian doctrine of eternal damnation, because eternal damnation is you're thrown into hell and that's it forever. And even if you repent and beg for forgiveness and have a change of heart, it doesn't matter. It's too late. You blew it. You're in hell and that's it. You're going to stay there. I remember when I was a child, I don't know how old, maybe 5 years old or something like this, I used to imagine, you know, because I've heard of this concept in the Christian Sunday schools. And, you know, I imagine people burning in hell, in the fires of hell, and I imagine myself, what would happen if I went to hell? And I thought, certainly I would repent, and I would call out to God, please God, help me, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I'll be good now. And then a voice comes from above, no, you must burn forever, ha 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 ha. This, you know, this idea of God was very frightening to me, and I couldn't really accept this perpetual damnation, or this eternal damnation. But perpetual is different. Perpetual means that as long as they want to remain in the material world, Krishna allows them to, because they have no desire to serve Krishna. They don't want to be liberated. They don't want to go back to Krishna, back to Godhead. They want to stay and whatever, and rot in this, try to enjoy this rotting material world. So then Krishna just allows them. He facilitates their desires, basically. So it's not that Krishna's cruel, but it's they who are cruel to themselves. And Krishna continues in the next verse. We'll chant half of the verse, because then there's some commentary. Asurim yunem apana mudha janmani janmani. Krishna says, attaining repeated birth among the species of life, of demoniac life, O son of Kunti, such persons can never approach me. So, hearing this statement, Arjuna becomes concerned. And in Baladeva Vibhushan, Arjuna, he comments that Arjuna is speaking to the Lord, and he says, but certainly, after many lifetimes, janmani, they should certainly receive your mercy, and then by your mercy, they'll be freed from their demoniac births, isn't it? And then Krishna says, no, these fools take birth in demoniac species of life, birth after birth. Failing to achieve me, they descend to the lower forms of life, taking evil, even the birth like dogs and hogs. So Arjuna is asking, well, you know, isn't there some chance that in the future birth they'll be purified? And then Krishna says, no. Mam aprapyaiva kaunteya tato yanti adamam gatim. So, mam aprapyaiva kaunteya. He used the word eva here. Certainly means that they will never get a chance to obtain me. As long as they have this mentality. And then they cannot even attain a good birth, which is a prerequisite for attaining me. And Krishna said the Vedas also describe this. It's mentioned in the Vedas that such persons, they take birth as dogs and hogs, and they do not attain a opportunity to to come to Krishna. So very strict and stringent, very heavy part of the Bhagavad Gita here. So then the question is raised, but my Lord, you are Satyasankalpa. Whatever you desire becomes true. You can save them. You can do it. And then Krishna says, yes, I can do Sankalpa. Satyasankalpa means whatever I want, it becomes reality, becomes Satya, truth. Sankalpa means desire of the mind. So whatever I desire, Krishna's Satyasankalpa. So Arjuna says, my Lord, you're Satyasankalpa. Whatever you want, that becomes reality. So you can liberate them. You can do it just by your desire. And Krishna says, yes, I could do Sankalpa if I had such a desire, but I don't even have the seed of this desire. So the reason why Krishna doesn't have the seed of this desire is because they don't want it. Because they don't want Krishna, so therefore Krishna doesn't interfere with their minute independence. This is the Lord's policy. If he were to interfere with the minute independence, then what kind of devotees would he have in the spiritual world? He wouldn't have spontaneous loving bhaktas there. He would have people that were kind of forced by his own will to come there to serve him. And he doesn't want this. He wants people who want him. Right? He wants them to love him, but if they don't love him, if they don't want him, then what can he do? He doesn't force them. So Krishna doesn't have this, he's not going to create a situation which is artificial. So therefore he doesn't have the seed of desire. And Burjan mentions this also in his books, Suranam to Me. He says, because such souls have no desire to get out of the material existence, they don't. They don't want Krishna's mercy, and so he doesn't give it to them. It's very simple. And Prabhupada mentions, it is clearly stated that the demons have practically no chance of receiving the mercy of God at any stage of later life. In the Vedas also it is stated that such persons gradually sink to become dogs and hogs. It may be then argued in this connection that God should not be advertised as all merciful if he is not merciful to such demons. In answer to this question, in Vedanta Sutra we find that the Supreme Lord has no hatred for anyone. The placing of the asuras, the demons, in the lowest status of life is simply another feature of his mercy. Sometimes the demons are killed by the Lord, but that killing is also good for them. In the Vedas we find that anyone who is killed by the Lord becomes liberated. Therefore, there are instances in history of many demons, Ravan, Kamsa, Hiranyakashipu, to whom the Lord appeared in various incarnations just to kill them. Therefore, God's mercy is shown to the asuras if they are fortunate enough to be killed by them. So the float in the lower species of life is even less more fortunate to be killed by the Lord. But so some of the demons are lucky and they get killed by the Lord if they're significant demons. But the average run-of-the-mill demon. So Baladeva Vidyabhushan comments, now Arjuna says, well, but people are not going to like this. After hearing about this, they're going to want to give up all of these demoniac qualities. But what can they do to get rid of these demoniac qualities? So Krishna answers this in the next verse. And this gives us a choice whether to reject all of these demoniac qualities somehow or other, or to allow them to continue to affect us. Trividham narakasyedam dvaram nashanam atmana kama krodas tata lobhas Tasmat etatrayam dhyajet. There are three gates leading to this hell: lust, anger, and greed. Every sane man should give these up, for they lead to the degradation of the soul. So the three gates to hell: kama, krodha, and lobha. Of course, we know there are three other gates, you know, southern gates, maybe less significant. That's moha, mada, and matsarya. These are the six enemies of the soul. And the commentators have mentioned all six of them, indicating that Krishna is indicating all of these six. There's three main gates, and they include the other three gates, the other three. So from kama or lust, everything else springs. Because when one's lusty, then all of the other bad qualities will manifest or develop in his heart. If someone is lusty and his desires are stopped or obstructed, then he develops krodha, anger. Just like a child who tries to, you know, grab a toy or something, and another child grabs it first. He's probably seen it 1,000 times. And then immediately he becomes angry and starts screaming and pounding his fist on the ground and so forth. So more or less, we're all like children. We want sense gratification, and when we don't get it, we become angry. This is a very simple knee-jerk reaction. It happens immediately. And even if the person is allowed to get these things, then does he become satisfied? No. He develops lobha. He becomes greedy because material desires are not satiated or satisfied. They increase more and more. So the person, if he gets his sense gratification, then he becomes lobhi. He becomes greedy. And then from greed develops illusion, because he becomes so absorbed in these things, the illusion of being the body, being the enjoyer, and so forth, captures his soul. He becomes enraptured in this greed and illusion. And then from this illusion is the kind of pride or madness, the madness of pride, mada. And then all of them, all rolled up into one, creates envy. Then there's envy. He's envious of people who have other things that he doesn't have, or people become envious of him, like this. So envy is a combination of lust and anger and greed and pride and illusion. That's why envy is like the most intense thing. If you analyze, if someone's envious, there's hatred and there's lust and greed, all of these things are there. And for a man, the woman embodies the pinnacle of sense gratification. All of the senses of the man become attracted to the form of the woman. The eyes become attracted to the beautiful form. The ears are attracted to the sweet voice. And the nose is attracted to the beautiful aroma of her perfumed body. The sense of touch is attracted to the softness of her skin, her baby-like complexion, and his sense of taste, his tongue is attracted to her mango sweet lips that he hankers to kiss. Right? So you can see how actually the form of the woman for the man is the embodiment of all his sensual attractions and all of his desires. All of the senses are absorbed totally in the form of the woman. And this is, therefore, for him, she's the form of Maya, which creates this karma. Works every time. It's amazing. Never ceases to amaze me. How the man is so attractive to the woman, but to another man, he's not attractive at all. Right? And the woman is not attracted to another woman. Right? It's a certain chemistry Krishna has created in the psyche, in the blood of the man, somehow attracted. And of course, vice versa, for the woman, the man is the embodiment of Maya. She is as attracted to the form of the man, the voice of the man, and the aroma of the sweat of the man, you know. she's attracted to the man's body, which for us just stinks, you know. We don't. But the woman, you know, she goes wild. Ah, man! You know? Actually, I read somewhere, I can't remember where it is. I've been looking, but I can't find it. But I remember very distinctly that Prabhupada said, for the woman, she's most attracted to the sound, the voice of the man. So her ears are the thing which captures her. And for the man, it's the eyes. Of course, the man has all the senses which are attracted, but especially the eyes. That's why they take advantage of this in advertising and so forth. They can, because if you're riding on the highway, you just kind of see something way off to the side which looks something like a woman. Immediately, boing, you know, your eyes just pulled over there, right? Something, anything that looks anything like a woman, you know. Immediately your eyes want to see what it is, who it is. Sometimes it's funny, you know, you may be like in the underground. This has happened to me, and I've heard other devotees say it too. You know, you're in the underground and you see this like long, beautiful hair and, you know, certain kind of dress or something, and then you look and then he turns around. You know, ugly man, he's got long hair and, right? Yeah, right. So. Or the woman will be really ugly, you know, and then you go, ah, but in your mind you think she's so beautiful. And it's like this. So the mind projects all of these things, you know, onto this form. Therefore, Mahaprabhu said that even the wooden form of the woman, he says it creates this Maya. It's very powerful. This is Krishna's energy. His, you know, Maya Shakti is so powerful. So only by his mercy, the mercy of Madan Mohan, can the devotee transcend all of his intense attractions and desires. Otherwise it's impossible. He's captured. Just like the elephant, captured by the sweet calls of the she elephant. I don't know what it sounds like. And he goes, wow, listen to that. But it's amazing that every species is attracted. The male female things there. The dogs, even the pigs, even the flies. You see the flies flying around, you know, together, one on top of the other one. You go, oh my God, they're doing it in the air. Isn't it? They have sex while they're flying, you know, through the air. And Maya is so heavy. She doesn't let anyone free from this attraction. Because anyone who takes birth in the material world, it's from Shiva and Parvati. And that's, once you're under their, you know, jurisdiction, that means you have kama. You know. So, yeah. So for the man, it's the seeing. Just like Bhuvamangala Thakur, he had already convinced himself from hearing a few words from Chintamani, revived his consciousness, his spiritual consciousness. He was determined, I'm going to Vrindavan, but still on the way, he was attracted to the beauty of the farmer's wife. And he came and approached them. But then he realized that it was these two eyes which was creating these problems. And he stuck. He asked for her hairpin and poked his eyes on. which is a pretty severe way to conquer, you know, the attraction of the eyes. Better to just keep meditating on Radha Shamasuna and hope that the eyes will be satisfied with their beauty. Yeah. And so many other ways. Well, this is one thing. So you notice that for the woman, the ears, right? She likes to hear the sound of the man's voice. So you'll notice that men who are woman hunters, they are very expert at talking to women. As they say, chatting up the birds in England. Right? They're very expert there. You see men who are hunting women, they just somehow speak in such a way and they just continue talking and talking and talking and kind of charming and glorifying the woman, and yeah, she becomes attractive and somehow he just captures her. This is the way. So this is the three gates to hell: kama, krodha, and lobha. And the other ones, these were actually exemplified by the demons that Jayan Vijay portrayed, or you know, created, I guess. Ravana represents kama because he was lusty after Sita. Actually, it comes in as, you know, there's the two Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. So Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, he was the first one, right? So we know that he was very interested in the gold in the earth, and he was excavating gold like this. So he was full of greed. He wanted to enjoy in that way. He was greedy. He kept taking out the gold. And Hiranyakashipu was very proud because he wanted to be the Lord of the universe. So he represents pride, mada. He thought he could become more powerful than Lord Brahma. And everyone was under his control. He thought that Vishnu has now hidden himself in fear of my power. And so he was very proud. And then you have Ravana and Kumbhakarna, two brothers again. And Ravana was very lusty after Sita. He captured her, another man's wife. I was thinking that actually even Ravana was more civilized than most men today. Most people today, they would have just forced themselves and raped Mother Sita. But Ravana didn't do that. He wanted Sita to marry him. Right? So he put her in the Ashokpan and just waited for her, you know. Of course, he was kind of in, you know, he was doing different things to create fear in her mind and so forth, but still, he didn't. Most men would have just, nowadays, would have just forced themselves. And then Kumbhakarna, we know he would wake up and then eat like three lorries of food and then go back to sleep for 6 months. And so he was in moha, illusion. I am this body. Eat and sleep and enjoy. And then finally, Shishupal, who was the embodiment of envy. He hated Krishna so much. He was envious. Just wanted to somehow get rid of Krishna. And that came out, especially during the Rajasuya Yajna of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Actually, Shishupala was born with three eyes and four arms and something like that. He was quite a weird child. His various appellations. And so when his mother saw this ugly looking child, she was shocked, and she went to the river and was ready to toss him in the river. But there was this prophetic Akashvani, you know, voice from the sky and said, "Stop! Do not kill your child." When the man who is to kill your child appears before him, then his appellation will disappear. So then she stopped. And she waited for that day. And it came to be that at one point, because they were relatives, Krishna and Vasudeva Devaki, they came to see Shishupal. And Krishna was a young boy, and as soon as he came up to the crib where Shishupal was then immediately the eye and the arms disappeared. This is described in Mahabharata. So then the mother was very happy that the child was now normal and looking. But also she was a little frightened that this is the person that's going to kill my son. So she got down on her hands and knees. She started praying, begging, "Please don't kill my child. It's been prophesied you would be the one that killed him." And then Krishna, being soft-hearted, he said, "Well, I cannot go against the will of providence, but I promise you, mother, that he may insult me 100 times, and I won't do anything." And she was satisfied. So throughout his life, Shishupal was, you know, criticizing Krishna. And especially in the Rajasuya Yajna, he really started letting it loose. Right? Because Bhishma was glorifying Krishna, that he's a great brahmachari, he's much better, greater than I could ever dance in the forest with these beautiful women and remain sober. No, he's better than I. We should elect him as president for the Rajasuya. And Nakul also, he was the one who elected, and others like this. So Shishupal stood up and he began criticizing a whole entourage, epiphany, and you can say, of criticisms towards the Lord. And so the Lord was sitting on his throne listening to Shishupal spit out his venomous poison in the form of criticism and blasphemy. And then he was just casually waiting. Of course, we know the Pandavas were on the side and they were burning with anger because they were hearing the Lord being blasphemed so vehemently. And Bhima, he stood up with his mace and his face was red. His eyes were red with anger. And Yudhisthira just told him, "Just cool down, Bhima. Just wait. The Lord has not given us permission to kill Shishupal. And besides, this is the Rajasuya Yajna. And if we don't want to kill him, you..." But Bhima was very angry. And Arjuna also stood up with his Gandiva bow. But the Lord pacified them, gave them some sign. And he just kept waiting, and Shishupal continued. And Krishna, in his mind, he was thinking, "All right, 95, 96, 97... 98, 99, 100! Ding, ding, you know." And then he took his Sudarshan disc and right to his neck. And it's described in the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti that as soon as the disc came right up to his neck, at the point of death, he had a change of heart. And he thought, "Oh my God, he's the Supreme Lord. I should surrender to him." Then his head was cut off. But it was too late. It was called the last moment surrender. He had a change of heart. He became a devotee. And his head was cut off. But his head was cut off in such a way that blood, not even one drop of blood touched the ground. Because it would have contaminated the sacrificial arena. So Krishna killed him somehow without dropping any blood. Of course, then there was a big outrage. Everyone stood up and they were screaming and they were the whole crowd. And those people who were Shishupal's friends, they all kind of snuck out the back door. They didn't want to get caught. So Shishupala is the epitome of envy. And then last but not least is the Krodha, the epitome of Krodha, and that's Dantavakra. Because after Krishna had killed Shishupala and some others, then Dantavakra was angry, and he met Lord Krishna on the battlefield, and Krishna just finished him off also, very quickly. Like he also cut off his head. So these incarnations of Jaya Vijaya, they represent these three, these six enemies of the soul. So by hearing these pastimes helps to purify us of these anarthas that are also within us. Because within our hearts we also have this ten-headed ravana, who's waiting to pop up his head. Occasionally, sometimes you can feel this ten-headed ravana attack you, maybe during your japa period or whenever, at night or something. So we should pray to Ram to shoot his illustrious arrows into our heart and kill the ten-headed ravana who dwells within. This is how we can pray. The Lord appears in these ways to kill these demons. And this is one, I guess, somewhat esoteric way of getting rid of these problems. There are some other ways. We may ask, how to conquer lust, anger, greed? So there are a few recommendations or suggestions given by Srila Prabhupada. Here's one found in the first canto, chapter 9. Text 27. It is the description of Bhishma at the point of his death. He's instructing Maharaj Yudhisthira about the duties or the divisions of Varnashram, about the king's activities and the duties of women and so forth. And in the penultimate paragraph, the third to last paragraph actually is, Prabhupada says, as far as salvation is concerned, one has to conquer the principles of lust, anger, unlawful desires, avarice, and bewilderment. To get freedom from anger, one should learn how to forgive. To be free from unlawful desires, one should not make plans. By spiritual culture, one is able to conquer sleep. By tolerance only can one conquer desires and avarice. Disturbances from various diseases can be avoided by regulated diets. By self-control, one can be free from false hopes. And money can be saved by avoiding undesirable association. By practice of yoga, one can control hunger. And worldliness can be avoided by culturing the knowledge of impermanence. Dizziness can be conquered by rising up, and false arguments can be conquered by factual ascertainment. Talkativeness can be avoided by gravity and silence, and by prowess one can avoid fearfulness. Perfect knowledge can be attained by self-cultivation. One must be free from lust, avarice, anger, dreaming, etc. to actually attain the path of salvation. Towards the end of the purport. And there's another place in the seventh canto, chapter 15, text 22 to 25. These are the verses themselves. Now I'll read. Now I'll just read the English. Text number 22. By discussing spiritual knowledge, one can conquer lamentation and illusion. By serving a great devotee, one can become prideless. By keeping silent, one can avoid obstacles on the path of mystic yoga. And simply by stopping sense gratification, one can conquer envy. Because then you have nothing to be envious of. 23. By good behavior and freedom from envy, one should counteract sufferings due to other living entities. By meditation in trance, one should counteract sufferings due to providence. And by practicing Hatha Yoga, Pranayama, and so forth, one should counteract sufferings due to the body and mind. Similarly, by developing the mode of goodness, especially in regard to eating, one should conquer sleep. Text 24. One must conquer the modes of passion and ignorance by developing the mode of goodness. And then one must become detached from the mode of goodness by promoting oneself to the mode, to the platform of Shuddhasattva. All this can be automatically done if one engages in the service of the spiritual master with faith and devotion. In this way, one can conquer the influence of the modes of nature. And text 25. The spiritual master should be considered to be directly the Supreme Lord because he gives transcendental knowledge for enlightenment. Consequently, for one who maintains the material conception that the spiritual master is an ordinary human being, everything is frustrated. His enlightenment and his Vedic studies and knowledge are just like the bathing of an elephant. Alright, so there are just a few tips about conquering these things. Canto 7, chapter 15, text 22 to 25. Oh, I missed one. I'm sorry. Oh. By making plans with determination, this is the first verse actually, by making plans with determination, one should give up lusty desires for sense gratification. Means you have to be proactive. You have to know what you want to do and make a plan to do it and then do it. Similarly, by giving up envy, one should conquer anger. By discussing the disadvantages of accumulating wealth, one should give up greed. And by discussing the truth, one should give up fear. Oh, okay, here's a commentary. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura suggested how one can conquer lusty desires for sense gratification. One cannot give up thinking of women, for thinking in this way is natural. Even while walking on the street, one will see so many women. However, if one is determined not to live with a woman, even while seeing a woman, he will not become lusty. If one is determined not to have sex, he can automatically conquer lusty desires. The example is given in this regard, that even if one is hungry, if on a particular day he is determined to observe fasting, he can naturally conquer the disturbances of hunger and thirst. If one is determined not to be envious of anyone, he can naturally conquer anger. Similarly, one can give up the desire to accumulate wealth simply by considering how difficult it is to protect the money in one's possession. If one keeps a large amount of cash with him, he's always anxious about keeping it properly. Isn't that true? You have like your little money pouch, right? Your money belt wrapped around you, and you go to the bathroom, you hang it up, and you kind of... right, or whatever. You leave it for a moment and... Thus, if one discusses the disadvantages of accumulating wealth, he can naturally give up business without difficulty. Okay, so anyway, those are some suggestions how to conquer these things. Someone may have some other suggestions how to conquer lust, anger, or greed. Or we were talking about this the other day in the other classroom, right? We made some of the bad qualities and, right, the demonic qualities, how to give up pride and anger and, right, being harsh, right? Does anyone have any ideas about these other ones, lust, anger, or greed? Did anything click maybe while I was reading? You thought, oh yeah, that's right. Or, that's one way to do it. Of course, the Prabhupada said that to the devotees in New York. If you're so agitated by women, then go in the forest. But then you can't do very much service if you're in the forest. Well, we know, you know, yeah. Pray, chant, study, serve the spiritual master. Right, wake up early, fasting. What else?
The point you said about being proactive, of making a plan and sticking to it, I think it's important because sometimes devotees, we don't have enough faith in Krishna that we to just like
stick to our plan. Because meaning dharma means duty, and you stick to your guns no matter what. That's what the whole Mahabharata is about, right? Even though they had to suffer so many things, they were men of principle, and they stuck to these principles. Nowadays, it's very rare to find a man or a woman of principle who they just, you know, they decide this is the right thing that should be done, and then they just do that instead of being swayed by so many things. And it's also, even the karmis, they say that, you know, the new age self-improvement people, they say once you determine yourself, you know, to do something, then something mystical happens, right? You determine yourself, and then the facilities and the energy and the power, you know, to carry out those things magically happen. But if you don't determine yourself, if you're not convinced, you're not convicted and committed to doing that, then those things will never, you know, come your way. But once you have the commitment and the conviction, then you find the path. You can perform that thing. Even they say that. So if they have realized this truth, then it must be a principle which can be understood as a kind of axiomatic truth, both in, because I mean, even the non-devotees, they have some understanding that there's some kind of, you know, give and take and action and reaction. You know, people that are a little bit mystical and so forth, a little liberal, they know that they may not believe that Krishna's God, but they know there's some kind of higher energy force that, if you act in a certain way, it reacts to you. So it's like that. Okay, let's just finish this and then you can ask questions. Hey, Terbi Mukta Kaunteya Tamodvaira Srivir Naraha Acharat Yatmana Shreyas Tato Yati Varam Nabhim. The man who has escaped these three gates of hell, Sanam Kunti, performs acts conducive to self-realization and thus gradually attains the supreme destination. So he performs acts for Shreya that are conducive for the ultimate benediction. And then, tata yati param vitim, he goes to that higher supreme destination. Prabhupada comments, one should be very careful of these three enemies to human life, lust, anger, and greed. The more a person is freed from lust, anger, and greed, the more his existence becomes pure. Then he can follow the rules and regulations enjoyed in Vedic literature. By following the regular principles of human life, one gradually raises himself to the platform of spiritual realization. If one is so fortunate, by such practice, to rise to the platform of Krishna consciousness, then success is guaranteed for him. In the Vedas, the ways of action and reaction are prescribed to enable one to come to the stage of purification. The whole method is based on giving up lust, greed, and anger. By cultivating knowledge of this process, one can be elevated to the highest position of self-realization. The self-realization is perfected in devotional service. In that devotional service, the liberation of the conditioned soul is guaranteed. Therefore, according to the Vedic system, there are instituted the four orders of life and the four statuses of life, called the caste system and the spiritual order system. There are different rules and regulations for different castes or divisions of society, and if a person is able to follow them, he will be automatically raised to the highest platform of spiritualization. Then he can have liberation without a doubt. So, Varnashram is the safety net for spiritual advancement. And it helps to regulate the senses and the mind so that one can gradually come to the mode of goodness and then to the spiritual platform. So to try to control the senses is necessary. There has to be restrictions and rules and regulations. You can't just throw everything out the window and just act whimsically and think that we've come to the spiritual platform somehow by some spontaneous love or something, you know, mystical mercy, you know, falling from the sky. But it takes practice and sense control. And by practicing, one gradually learns how to conquer lust, anger, and greed. But if one doesn't restrict himself and struggle a little bit, then he won't come to that. There has to be some struggle. Prabhupada said previously in chapter 6, I believe, that it is the duty of the transcendentalist to strenuously try to control his desire and anger. To strive strenuously to try to control these things, the desires and anger. So it's not that it's an easy path. There's struggle, but the struggle is part of the practice. But the struggle can't be so insurmountable that it overwhelms the person. Therefore, there's four ashrams and there's four varnas. But the ashrams mainly abiding by certain rules, and the varnas are your swabhava, your nature for working. Right? So the varnas are for your kind of natural proclivity, and the ashrams are for following certain rules to bring you to the point of sense control. So the sannyasis have much stricter rules and regulations. And the vanaprasthas also. And the grihasthas less. And the brahmacharis are just students, they're beginning. So everyone can slot into where they feel comfortable. But we see Prabhupada says that by following these rules and regulations, these regulative principles, then one gradually raises himself to the spiritual platform. So there is some, you can say, suppression or of the lust that has to be suppressed. But it can't be, it has to be within those varna and ashram, within the ashrams particularly. Because otherwise it will be too difficult, the person will be overwhelmed. So therefore we see Prabhupada's method was like that. He said this was the bottom, you know, rock bottom rules and regulations, the four regs. No meat eating, no intoxication or gambling or illicit sex. That has a bottom line, has to be there. And if one can't do that, he may be still considered a devotee of some sort, but he should struggle to come to that level. And of course, if someone can do that, or if he does it and then later falls down, then, you know, we shouldn't poo-poo him or criticize him or condescendingly speak to, you know, about him or, you know, criticize him, blaspheme him. But we should feel compassion for the person, you know. That at least we should glorify him. At least he tried to do something. He knows what is the right thing. He tried to do it. He couldn't do it. So anyway, what can be done? This is the problem, like in, you know, if we would discuss the social issues of ISKCON, because we have these strict rules and regulations, and we know there are many people that find it very foreboding and difficult to follow. And those who are following, sometimes they become proud that we're following these and you're not, and you're, you know, or whatever. It may take the form of we're temple devotees and you're outside. Congregational people and so forth. So that pride can be there, and this creates a dichotomy, a friction, you know, between different types of devotees. But the devotees who are strict and are able to somehow, by the mercy of Krishna and Guru, to follow the principles without too much struggle, then they should just try to help the other ones who can't follow and be merciful and compassionate to them and not feel superior to them. And then those devotees who can't follow so strictly and who are trying or struggling, then they'll feel encouraged. Then they'll feel, you know, desirous to come up to the standard. So it's just a matter of adjusting the attitudes of the different people in ISKCON and in greater ISKCON, so that everyone can feel encouraged. And, but at the same time, we have our standards. We want to keep those standards because Prabhupada kept those. If someone can follow them, then let him, you know, continue trying. And we should just be patient with them and let them, give them time. It's not a big thing, you know, because everyone's different. Everyone has to have their approach it at in their own speed. Okay, the last two verses now. Krishna summarizes the chapter from with one negative statement and then a positive statement. 23 is the negative statement. Ya shastra vidam utsrija vartate kama karata nasa siddhim avapnoti nasukam naparangatim. He who discards scriptural injunctions and acts according to his own whims attains neither perfection nor happiness nor the supreme destination. So, ya shastra vidam utsrija, those who give up following the rules of the shastra, vartate kamakarata, and they just follow their own whims lustfully, then nasasidim, they don't attain perfection, nasukim, they're not happy, they don't, definitely don't come to the supreme destination. Prabhupada comments, the word kamakarata, the second paragraph, is significant. A person who knowingly violates the rules, acts in lust, he knows that this is forbidden, but still he acts. This is called acting whimsically. He knows that this should be done, but still he does not do it. Therefore he is called whimsical. Such persons are destined to be condemned by the Lord. Such persons cannot have the perfection which is meant for the human life. The human life is meant, especially meant for purifying one's existence. And one who does not follow the rules and regulations cannot purify himself, nor can he attain the real stage of happiness. Some people who just follow their lust, actually not happy. We see that's true. People may have lots of money, they may enjoy illicit sex, take drugs, intoxication, have power over others, and still they're very disturbed. Well, many people can't sleep at night, they have to take pills to relax their anxiety. Because their goal is kamapabhoga parama epiva iti nishchita. The goal of lust and enjoyment. Therefore they're in anxiety. I remember I was living once in a boarding house. It was just a house where there was a few different rooms and the lady was renting them out. And there was a red-haired girl who lived there. She was a secretary at some company, and after a very short time, I noticed that, you know, practically every week she had a new boyfriend that would come and call, knock on the door and take her out to the clubs and pubs and so forth. And then she'd come back at 4 and 5 in the morning or something and, you know, smoke a cigarette and have a cup of coffee and then go to work. Something like this. So, after a few months of being there, and, you know, naturally I, you know, developed some kind of relationship with this person. And I asked her, I said, are you really happy living like this? You know, got all different boyfriends and you don't have any real relationship with anyone, and, you know, what is it? Are you really happy? And I asked her point blank, looked her in the eyes, and she started crying. Yeah, she was so surprised. But many people are like this. They just try to live life in a fling, you know, just running here, running there, this boyfriend, that boyfriend, this car, money, jobs, and this and that. But inside their heart, if you really ask them point blank, they're suffering, actually, because there's no principle of love. There's just sense gratification to try to, you know, get a cheap thrill, to, you know, bide the time of human life, but there's no real love, nothing really deep in the heart where they feel secure and happy and peaceful and loved, and there's nothing like this. Most people in the West, at least, are like this. And the funny thing is everyone in the East is, you know, imitating those in the West, so they're becoming like them also. They think this is happiness, but really, if you get down to it, those people are the most disturbed. You know, the psychiatric business in America is booming. Yeah, they're the biggest business in the whole world. They're making billions of dollars because people are, you know, disturbed. They need help. They're going crazy. So this is the nature of sense gratification. It doesn't give one happiness. What to speak of siddhim and padamgatim? They're not going to attain any kind of perfection in life. So, okay, we'll read the last verse now. So now the positive recommendation, and this is the conclusion of the chapter. So we see the word tasmat, which means therefore. Tasmat chastram pramanam te karya karya vivastito gyatva shastram vidhanoktam karma karatum viharasi. One should therefore understand what is duty and what is not duty by the regulations of the scriptures. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act so that he may gradually be elevated. So here Krishna is saying we must accept the evidence of the shastra, tasmat shastram pramanam te karya karya, because this is how we know what to do and what not to do, because Krishna knows the different levels of human consciousness, and he knows how to, by setting rules and regulations, gradually elevate one through social rules and regulations to bring one up to higher status of consciousness, to the mode of goodness. So therefore the rules and regulations in the shastras are beneficial because they help to regulate the human mind and senses to gradually bring one to the mode of goodness. So we have to accept Guru Sadhana and Shastra, or we have the choice to, we can reject them and accept our own mind and senses as our leader or guru. But this mental guru has kept us bound in the material world since the beginning of time. And it will continue to keep us in this cycle of birth and death. But the Shastra makes it very clear which are the activities which bind one in this world and which activities liberate one. So the Shastras condemn or restrict the activities that bind one, and they recommend the activities which liberate one. So therefore, by following Shastra, one gradually comes to the point of liberation. So we naturally avoid the first things and we perform the activities which help to liberate us. And this is Prabhupada's, we'll just read his commentary also. As stated in the 15th chapter, all the rules of the Vedas are meant for knowing Krishna. If one understands Krishna from the Gita and becomes situated in Krishna consciousness, engaging himself in bhakti, he has reached the highest perfection of knowledge offered by the Vedas. Lord Chaitanya made this process very easy. He asked people simply to chant the Maha Mantra and to engage in devotional service of the Lord and eat remnants of the foodstuff offered to the deity. One who is directly engaged in all these devotional activities is to be understood as having studied all Vedas. He has come to the conclusion perfectly. Of course, for the ordinary persons who are not in Krishna consciousness or who are not engaged in devotional service, what is to be done and what is not to be done must be decided by the injunctions of the Vedas. One should act accordingly without argument. That is called following principles of Shastra. Shastra is without the four principal defects that are visible in the conditioned soul. Perfect senses, propensity of cheating, committing mistakes, and being illusion. These four principal defects disqualify one from putting forth rules and regulations. Therefore, the rules as described in the Shastra, being above these defects, are accepted without alteration by all sadhus. In India, there are many parties of spiritual understanding, generally classified as two, the impersonalist and personalist. Both of them, however, lead their lives according to the Vedas. Without the principle of Shastra, one cannot elevate himself to the perfectional stage. One who actually, therefore, understands the purport of the Shastras is considered fortunate. In human society, aversion to the principles of understanding the Lord is the cause of all fall downs. That is the greatest offense in human life. Therefore, Maya is always giving us trouble in the shape of threefold miseries. His material energy is constituted of the three modes. One has to raise himself at least to goodness before the path to understanding the Lord can be opened. Without raising oneself to the standard of the mode of goodness, one remains in ignorance and passion, which are the cause of demoniac life. Those in the modes of passion and ignorance deride the scriptures, deride the holy man, and deride the proper understanding of the Lord. They disobey the injunctions of the spiritual master and do not care for the regulations of Shastra. In spite of hearing the glories of bhakti, they are not attracted. Thus they manufacture their own way of elevation. These are some of the defects of human society which lead to the demoniac status of life. If, however, one is able to be guided by a proper and bona fide guru who can lead one to the path of elevation to the higher stage, then one's life becomes successful. So that's it. Any questions? Good question. Well, one way is if they took prasadam or somehow some miracle happens. Yeah, this is a, you know, one question which I haven't fully understood the answer to. I mean, generally the idea is that although we're put into lower species, the soul rises to the human form again, and at that point he gets the opportunity. Now, if he comes to the human form again and he's still envious of Krishna and he hates Krishna, then Krishna, after that lifetime, he'll send him back down again. And then he'll have to go through all of those millions of species again. And then he may come up again and he may still be envious. No, I won't surrender. There is no God. Okay. And he sends him back down again. So this may happen a few times. And after some time, you know, Krishna may say, well, what's the use of bringing him to the human form? Just let him stay there. He may just continue like this for ad infinitum. Of course, Krishna's in the heart even when he's in the lower species. So if Krishna senses that there's going to be a change of the heart, then he will give him the opportunity. But as long as he sees that there's no even chance of his changing his desire, then why should he give him a human form of life? I think this is the answer, it's the super soul. Because even when he's in the lower species, the super soul can still perceive. So therefore, if he knows that still he's envious, then he won't give him his opportunity. Krishna knows. Animal body, but he's still a spirit soul, and Krishna's still in his heart. That's true. Generally, animals don't think of God. But can't you understand that Krishna Krishna knows when the person's ready to surrender? When that soul is going to actually, you know, change his heart? Whatever body is in. That's my point. He can. Why can't he? It's possible. I mean, there are animals that come and they bow down to the temple and they take prasadam and they serve the devotees. There are such, right? And padayatri is the only dogs and that follow and, you know, dance in kirtan and all of these things. Of course. But if he's a demon, he's not going to be loving to the devotees and follow the kirtan. And I mean, these may be rare cases, but I mean, I also think, I mean, in general, it's a rare case to find someone who's, you know, so severely envious of God that that God may give him chance again and again to come to the human species, and then again and again, again and again, he refuses. So. But Krishna can tell in his heart when he's, whatever body he's in, he can tell. Krishna's there in the heart. So he knows.
Guruji, in the beginning, it just seems like almost as if in the beginning, we're sort of misled and then we.
Trick. in like a needle and out like a plow. Yeah, that's preaching. It's a trick. Well, you know, it's like, okay, you can just chant Hare Krishna and take prasadam, and certainly you'll get a lot of benefit, right? But as you purify yourself, you begin to realize that, wow, I really would like to get free from the clutches of Maya. It's not so easy. I would like to strengthen my consciousness, right? And I would like to get some help, assistance on my path to God. So then when we hear about things which are helpful, you know, like varnashram or studying shastra or sadhusanga or so many things, then we become eager to get those things and learn about them and follow them. In other words, it's kind of like an organic acceptance of different rules and regulations when we find that they're helpful to bring us to the thing that we want. Then we're propelled by our own desire that, yeah, oh, there's these things that, hey, Prabhu, didn't you hear about this, you know, this VIHE? They're giving these seminars, you know, and you can go there and live in Vrindavan for 5 months and study and da-da-da-da-da. And they think, wow, that's far out. I would really like that, you know. That sounds a lot better than just slugging it out here and, you know, in the West and, you know, suffering, struggling with all the modes. And you know, let me try to go deeper into Krishna consciousness. So then it's like something which is to your advantage that you want to take up to assist you, to help you in your goal, the thing that you want to do. So the rules and regulations are there. I mean, there's so many rules and regulations we still don't follow that are in Hari Bhakti Vilas or this and that. And Prabhupada said if you knew all the rules, you'd faint. You know? But just to make it simple, in the beginning, if you give people the mantra and ask them to take prasadam, then actually on their own volition, they'll want to follow the four principles. They'll want to come to the RTs and listen to the Bhagavatam class. They'll want to wear devotional clothing. They'll want to stop eating karmic food and junk food from the stores. You know, I mean, we do these because we know they're good for us. But it's not like we're just armed with all these rules and then we just throw them at people. And then they just become overwhelmed by these things. It's an organic acceptance according to the desires of the individual. I mean, yeah, there's so many things. I mean, become more advanced, then there's more subtle things that help us. And it's true, he tricked us. So what to do now? Now you've been... catch the fish or the lure? Yeah. You can still get good prasadam. Anyway, are you complaining? Huh? This is a complaint? Yes, it's true. Prabhupada tricked us. So, it's okay. Most of us like that we were tricked. Just like on book distribution, you know, you meet someone and you give them a book and you say it's about simple living and high thinking, developing your inner potentials, and then you get some Lakshmi. And then they look at the book and say, hey, wait a minute, this is all about religion. You tricked me. Anyway, you did a pretty good job of it. You guys are all right. And they walk away, you know. It's for our ultimate good. So it's okay to do that. As long as we're not being lied to. So Prabhupada didn't lie to us. He said, yeah, this Krishna is God. Did process the hearing and chanting, dancing, taking the prasadam. And... yeah, it's not. It's simple for the simple. He also said, "Don't be surprised who leaves." That means he knows there are many difficulties, but he knows that even if you leave, even after that you have struggle and you leave, then it's for your benefit. Next time you come around, it'll be easier. So it's a divine trick. We'll stop now. 6:30. Okay. Shri Prabhupada ki.